Plans for Total War. Still, Adolf Hitler did not rise to the Russian bait. Perhaps it was because all during June he was busy at Berchtesgaden supervising the completion of military plans to invade Poland at the summer's end. By June 15th, he had General von Brauchitsch's top-secret plan for the operations of the army against Poland. The object of the operation, the commander-in-chief of the army, echoing his master, declared, is to destroy the Polish armed forces. The political leadership demands that the war should be begun by heavy surprise blows and lead to quick successes. The intention of the Army High Command is to prevent a regular mobilization and concentration of the Polish army by a surprise invasion of Polish territory, and to destroy the mass of the Polish army, which is expected to be west of the Vistula-Narew line, by a concentrated attack from Silesia on the one side and from Pomerania, East Prussia, on the other. To carry out his plan, Brauchitsch set up two army groups. Army Group South, consisting of the 8th, 10th, and 14th armies, and Army Group North, made up of the 3rd and 4th armies. The Southern Army Group, under the command of General von Rundstedt, was to attack from Silesia in the general direction of Warsaw, scatter opposing Polish forces, and occupy as early as possible, with forces as strong as possible, the Vistula on both sides of Warsaw, with the aim of destroying the Polish forces still holding out in western Poland in cooperation with Army Group North. The first mission of the latter group was to establish connection between the Reich and East Prussia by driving across the corridor. Detailed objectives for the various armies were outlined, as well as those for the Air Force and Navy. Danzig, said Brauchitsch, would be declared German territory on the first day of hostilities and would be secured by local forces under German command. A supplemental directive issued at the same time stipulated that the order of deployment for White would be put into operation on August 20th. All preparations, it laid down, must be concluded by that date. A week later, on June 22nd, General Keitel submitted to Hitler a preliminary timetable for Case White. The Führer, after studying it, agreed with it in the main, but ordered that, so as not to disquiet the population by calling up reserves on a larger scale than usual, civilian establishments, employers, or other private persons who make inquiries should be told that men are being called up for the autumn maneuvers. Also, Hitler stipulated that, for reasons of security, the clearing of hospitals in the frontier area which the Supreme Command of the Army proposed should take place from the middle of July must not be carried out. The war which Hitler was planning to launch would be total war, and would require not only military mobilization, but a total mobilization of all the resources of the nation. To coordinate this immense effort, a meeting of the Reich Defense Council was convoked the next day, on June 23rd, under the chairmanship of Göring. Some 35 ranking officials, civil and military, including Keitel, Raeder, Halder, Thomas, and Milk, for the armed forces, and the ministers of the Interior, Economics, Finance, and Transport, as well as Himmler, were present. It was only the second meeting of the Council, but, as Göring explained, the body was convoked only to make the most important decisions, and he left no doubt in the minds of his hearers, as the captured secret minutes of the session reveal, that war was near, and that much remained to be done about manpower for industry and agriculture, and about many other matters relating to total mobilization. Göring informed the Council that Hitler had decided to draft some 7 million men. To augment the labor supply, Dr. Funk, the Minister of Economics, was to arrange what work is to be given to prisoners of war and to the inmates of prisons and concentration camps. Himmler chimed in to say that greater use will be made of the concentration camps in wartime. And Göring added that hundreds of thousands of workers from the Czech Protectorate are to be employed under supervision in Germany, particularly in agriculture, and housed in hutments. Already it was obvious the Nazi program for slave labor was taking shape. Dr. Frick, the Minister of the Interior, promised to save labor in the public administration and enlivened the proceedings by admitting that under the Nazi regime the number of bureaucrats had increased from 20 to 40-fold, an impossible state of affairs. A committee was set up to correct this lamentable situation. An even more pessimistic report was made by Colonel Rudolf Gerke, chief of the Transport Department of the Army General Staff. In the transportation sphere, he declared bluntly, Germany is at the moment not ready for war. Whether the German transportation facilities would be equal to their task depended, of course, on whether the war was confined to Poland. If it had to be fought in the West against France and Great Britain, it was feared that the transport system would simply not be adequate. In July, two emergency meetings of the Defense Council were called in order to bring the West Wall, by August 25th at the latest, into the optimum condition of preparedness with the material that can be obtained by that time by an extreme effort. High officials of Krupp and the steel cartel were enlisted to try to scrape up the necessary metal to complete the armament of the Western fortifications. For on their impregnancy, the Germans knew, depended whether the Anglo-French armies would be inclined to mount a serious attack on Western Germany while the Wehrmacht was preoccupied in Poland. Though Hitler, with unusual frankness, had told his generals on May 23rd that Danzig was not the cause of the dispute with Poland at all, it seemed for a few weeks at midsummer that the Free City might be the powder keg which any day would set off the explosion of war. For some time, the Germans had been smuggling into Danzig arms and regular army officers to train the local defense guard in their use. On June 19th, the high command of the army had informed the Foreign Office that 168 German army officers have been granted permission to travel through the Free State of Danzig in civilian clothes on a tour for study purposes. Early in July, General Keitel inquired of the Foreign Office whether it is politically advisable to show in public the 12 light and 4 heavy guns which are in Danzig and to let exercises be carried out with them, or whether it is better to conceal the presence of these guns. How the Germans succeeded in smuggling in heavy artillery past the Polish inspectors is not revealed in the German papers. The arms and officers came in across the border from East Prussia, and in order to keep closer watch on them, the Poles increased the number of their customs officials and frontier guards. The local Danzig authorities, now operating exclusively on orders from Berlin, countered by trying to prevent the Polish officials from carrying out their duties. The conflict reached a crisis on August 4th, when the Polish diplomatic representative in Danzig informed the local authorities that the Polish customs inspectors had been given orders to carry out their functions with arms, that any attempt by the Danzigers to hamper them would be regarded as an act of violence against Polish officials, and that in such a case the Polish government would retaliate without delay against the Free City. This was a further sign to Hitler that the Poles could not be intimidated, and it was reinforced by the opinion of the German ambassador in Warsaw, who on July 6th telegraphed Berlin that there was hardly any doubt that Poland would fight if there was a clear violation of her rights in Danzig. We know from a marginal note on the telegram in Ribbentrop's handwriting that it was shown the Führer. Hitler was furious. The next day, August 7th, he summoned Albert Forster, the Nazi Gauleiter of Danzig, to Berchtesgaden and told him that he had reached the extreme limit of his patience with the Poles. Angry notes were exchanged between Berlin and Warsaw, so violent in tone that neither side dared to make them public. On the 9th, the Reich government warned Poland that a repetition of its ultimatum to Danzig would lead to an aggravation of German-Polish relations, for which the German government must disclaim all responsibility. The next day, the Polish government replied tartly that they will continue to react as hitherto to any attempt by the authorities of the Free City to impair the rights and interests which Poland enjoys in Danzig, and will do so by such means and measures as they alone may deem appropriate, and that they will regard any intervention by the Reich government as an act of aggression. No small nation which stood in Hitler's way had ever used such language. When on the following day, August 11th, the Führer received Karl Burkhardt, a Swiss who was the League of Nations High Commissioner at Danzig, and who had gone more than halfway to meet the German demands there, he was in an ugly mood. He told his visitor that if the slightest thing was attempted by the Poles, he would fall upon them like lightning with all the powerful arms at his disposal, of which the Poles had not the slightest idea. Monsieur Burkhardt said, the High Commissioner later reported, that that would lead to a general conflict. Herr Hitler replied that if he had to make war, he would rather do it today than tomorrow, that he would not conduct it like the Germany of Wilhelm II, who had always had scruples about the full use of every weapon, and that he would fight without mercy up to the extreme limit. Against whom? Against Poland, certainly. Against Britain and France, if necessary. Against Russia, too? With regard to the Soviet Union, Hitler had finally made up his mind. The intervention of Russia. 3. A fresh initiative had come from the Russians. On July 18th, E. Babarian, the Soviet trade representative in Berlin, accompanied by two aides, called on Julius Schnurrer at the German Foreign Office and informed him that Russia would like to extend and intensify German-Soviet economic relations. He brought along a detailed memorandum for a trade agreement calling for a greatly increased exchange of goods between the two countries, and declared that if a few differences between the two parties were clarified, he was empowered to sign a trade treaty in Berlin. The Germans, as Dr. Schnurrer's confidential memorandum of the meeting shows, were rather pleased. Such a treaty, Schnurrer noted, will not fail to have its effect at least in Poland and Britain. 4 days later, on July 22nd, the Russian press announced in Moscow that Soviet-German trade negotiations had been resumed in Berlin. On the same day, Weizsäcker rather exuberantly wired Ambassador von der Schulenburg in Moscow some interesting new instructions. As to the trade negotiations, he informed the ambassador, we will act here in a markedly forthcoming manner, since a conclusion, and this at the earliest possible moment, is desired here for general reasons. As far as the purely political aspect of our conversations with the Russians is concerned, he added, we regard the period of waiting stipulated for you in our telegram, of June 30th, as having expired. You are therefore empowered to pick up the threads again there, without in any way pressing the matter. They were, in fact, picked up 4 days later, on July 26th, in Berlin. Dr. Schnurrer was instructed by Ribbentrop to dine Astakov, the Soviet chargé, and Babarian at a swank Berlin restaurant and sound them out. The two Russians needed little sounding. As Schnurrer noted in his confidential memorandum of the meeting, the Russians stayed until about 12:30 a.m., and talked in a very lively and interested manner about the political and economic problems of interest to us. Astakov, with the warm approval of Babarian, declared that a Soviet-German political rapprochement corresponded to the vital interests of the two countries. In Moscow, he said, they had never quite understood why Nazi Germany had been so antagonistic to the Soviet Union. The German diplomat, in response, explained that German policy in the East had now taken an entirely different course. On our part, there could be no question of menacing the Soviet Union. Our aims were in an entirely different direction. German policy was aimed at Britain. I could imagine a far-reaching arrangement of mutual interests with due consideration for vital Russian problems. However, this possibility would be barred the moment the Soviet Union aligned itself with Britain against Germany. The time for an understanding between Germany and the Soviet Union was opportune now, but would no longer be so after the conclusion of a pact with London. What could Britain offer Russia? At best, participation in a European war and the hostility of Germany. What could we offer against this? Neutrality and keeping out of a possible European conflict, and, if Moscow wished, a German-Russian understanding on mutual interests, which, just as in former times, would work out to the advantage of both countries. Controversial problems between Germany and Russia did not, in my opinion, exist anywhere along the line from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea and to the Far East. In addition, despite all the divergences in their views of life, there was one thing common to the ideology of Germany, Italy, and the Soviet Union: opposition to the capitalist democracies in the West. Thus, in the late evening hours of July 26th, in a small Berlin restaurant over good food and wine partaken by second-string diplomats, was Germany's first serious bid for a deal with Soviet Russia made. The new line which Schnurrer took had been given him by Ribbentrop himself. Astakov was pleased to hear it. He promised Schnurrer that he would report it at once to Moscow. In the Wilhelmstrasse, the Germans waited impatiently to see what the reaction in the Soviet capital would be. 3 days later, on July 29th, Weizsäcker sent a secret dispatch by courier to Schulenburg in Moscow. It would be important for us to know whether the remarks made to Astakov and Babarian have met with any response in Moscow. If you see an opportunity of arranging a further conversation with Molotov, please sound him out on the same lines. If this results in Molotov abandoning the reserve he has so far maintained, you could go a step further. This applies in particular to the Polish problem. we would be prepared, however the Polish problem may develop, to safeguard all Soviet interests and to come to an understanding with the government in Moscow. In the Baltic question, too, if the talks took a positive course, the idea could be advanced of so adjusting our attitude to the Baltic states as to respect vital Soviet interests in the Baltic Sea. 2 days later, on July 31st, the State Secretary wired Schulenburg, urgent and secret. With reference to our dispatch of July 29th arriving in Moscow by courier today, please report by telegram the date and time of your next interview with Molotov as soon as it is fixed. We are anxious for an early interview. For the first time, a note of urgency crept into the dispatches from Berlin to Moscow. There was good reason for Berlin's sense of urgency. On July 23rd, France and Britain had finally agreed to Russia's proposal that military staff talks be held at once to draw up a military convention which would spell out specifically how Hitler's armies were to be met by the three nations. Although Chamberlain did not announce this agreement until July 31st, when he made it to the House of Commons, the Germans got wind of it earlier. On July 28th, Ambassador von Feltscheck in Paris wired Berlin that he had learned from an unusually well-informed source that France and Britain were dispatching military missions to Moscow, and that the French group would be headed by General Dumont, whom he described as being a particularly capable officer and a former deputy chief of staff under General Maxime Weygand. It was the German ambassador's impression, as he stated in a supplementary dispatch 2 days later, that Paris and London had agreed to military staff talks as a last means of preventing the adjournment of the Moscow negotiations. It was a well-founded impression. As the confidential British Foreign Office papers make clear, the political talks in Moscow had reached an impasse by the last week in July, largely over the impossibility of reaching a definition of indirect aggression. To the British and French, the Russian interpretation of that term was so broad that it might be used to justify Soviet intervention in Finland and the Baltic states, even if there were no serious Nazi threat. And to this, London, at least, the French were prepared to be more accommodating, would not agree. Also, on June 2nd, the Russians had insisted that a military agreement setting down in detail the methods, form, and extent of the military help which the three countries were to give each other should come into force at the same time as the Mutual Assistance Pact itself. The Western powers, which did not think highly of Russia's military prowess, tried to put Molotov off. The British High Command, like the German later, grossly underestimated the potential strength of the Red Army. This may have been due in large part to the reports it received from its military attachés in Moscow. On March 6th, for instance, Colonel Firebrace, the military attaché, and Wing Commander Halliwell, the air attaché, had filed long reports to London to the effect that while the defensive capabilities of the Red Army and Air Force were considerable, they were incapable of mounting a serious offensive. Halliwell thought that the Russian Air Force, like the Army, is likely to be brought to a standstill as much by the collapse of essential services as by enemy action. Firebrace found that the purge of higher officers had severely weakened the Red Army. But he did point out to London that the Red Army considers war inevitable and is undoubtedly being strenuously prepared for it. They would only agree to starting staff talks after the political agreement had been signed. But the Russians were adamant. When the British tried to strike a bargain, offering on July 17th to begin staff conversations at once if the Soviet Union would yield on its insistence on signing political and military agreements simultaneously, and also, for good measure, accept the British definition of indirect aggression, Molotov answered with a blunt rejection. Unless the French and British agreed to political and military agreements in one package, he said, there was no point in continuing the negotiations. This Russian threat to end the talks caused consternation in Paris, which seems to have been more acutely aware than London of the course of Soviet-Nazi flirtations, and it was largely due to French pressure that the British government on August 23rd, while refusing to accept the Russian proposals on indirect aggression, reluctantly agreed to negotiate a military convention. Chamberlain was less than lukewarm to the whole business of staff talks. Strang, negotiating with Molotov in Moscow, was even cooler. "It is indeed extraordinary," he wrote the Foreign Office on July 20th, that we should be expected to talk military secrets with the Soviet government before we are sure that they will be our allies. The Russian view was just the opposite, and was put by Molotov to the Anglo-French negotiators on July 27th. The important point was to see how many divisions each party would contribute to the common cause, and where they would be located. Before the Russians committed themselves politically, they wanted to know how much military help they could expect from the West. On August 1st, Ambassador von Dirksen in London informed Berlin that the military negotiations with the Russians were regarded skeptically in British government circles. "This is borne out," he wrote, "by the composition of the British military mission." The British mission consisted of Admiral Sir Reginald Plunkett, Colonel Earl Drax, who had been Commander-in-Chief, Plymouth, 1935 to 1938, Air Marshal Sir Charles Burnett, and Major General Haywood. The Admiral is practically on the retired list and was never on the naval staff. The General is also purely a combat officer. The Air Marshal is outstanding as a pilot and an instructor, but not as a strategist. This seems to indicate that the task of the military mission is rather to ascertain the fighting value of the Soviet forces than to conclude agreements on operations. The Wehrmacht attachés are agreed in observing a surprising skepticism in British military circles about the forthcoming talks with the Soviet armed forces. Indeed, so skeptical was the British government that it neglected to give Admiral Drax written authority to negotiate, an oversight, if it was that, which Marshal Voroshilov complained about when the staff officers first met. The Admiral's credentials did not arrive until August 21st, when they were no longer of use. But if Admiral Drax had no written credentials, he certainly had secret written instructions as to the course he was to take in the military talks in Moscow. As the British Foreign Office papers much later revealed, the Admiral was admonished to go very slowly with the military conversations, watching the progress of the political negotiations until a political agreement had been concluded. It was explained to him that confidential military information could not be imparted to the Russians until the political pact was signed. But since the political conversations had been suspended on August 2nd, and Molotov had made it clear that he would not assent to their being renewed until the military talks had made some progress, the conclusion can scarcely be escaped that the Chamberlain government was quite prepared to take its time in spelling out the military obligations of each country in the proposed mutual assistance pact. A conclusion reached by Arnold Toynbee and his collaborators in their book The Eve of War, 1939, based largely on the British Foreign Office documents. In fact, the confidential British Foreign Office documents leave little doubt that by the beginning of August, Chamberlain and Halifax had almost given up hope of reaching an agreement with the Soviet Union to stop Hitler, but thought that if they stretched out the staff negotiations in Moscow, this might somehow deter the German dictator from taking, during the next 4 weeks, the fatal step toward war. On August 16th, Air Marshal Sir Charles Burnett wrote to London from Moscow, "I understand it is the government's policy to prolong negotiations as long as possible, if we cannot get acceptance of a treaty." Seeds, the British ambassador in Moscow, had wired London on July 24th, the day after his government agreed to staff talks, "I am not optimistic as to the success of military conversations, nor do I think they can in any case be rapidly concluded. But to begin with them now would give a healthy shock to the Axis powers, and a fillip to our friends, while they might be prolonged sufficiently to tide over the next dangerous few months." In view of what Anglo-French intelligence knew of the meetings of Molotov with the German ambassador, of German efforts to interest Russia in a new partition of Poland, which Kulondra had warned Paris of as early as May 7th, of massive German troop concentrations on the Polish border, and of Hitler's intentions, this British trust in stalling in Moscow is somewhat startling. In contrast to the British and French, the Russians placed on their military mission the highest officers of their armed forces. Marshal Voroshilov, who was Commissar for Defense, General Shaposhnikov, Chief of the General Staff of the Red Army, and the Commanders-in-Chief of the Navy and Air Force. The Russians could not help noting that whereas the British had sent the chief of the Imperial General Staff, General Sir Edmund Ironside, to Warsaw in July for military talks with the Polish General Staff, they did not consider sending this ranking British officer to Moscow. It cannot be said that the Anglo-French military missions were exactly rushed to Moscow. A plane would have got them there in a day, but they were sent on a slow boat, a passenger cargo vessel, which took as long to get them to Russia as the Queen Mary could have conveyed them to America. They sailed for Leningrad on August 5th and did not arrive in Moscow until August 11th. By that time, it was too late. Hitler had beaten them to it. While the British and French military officers were waiting for their slow boat to Leningrad, the Germans were acting swiftly. August 3rd was a crucial day in Berlin and Moscow. At 12:58 p.m. on that day, Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop, who invariably left the sending of telegrams to State Secretary von Weizsäcker, got off on his own a wire marked "Secret, most urgent" to Schulenburg in Moscow. "Yesterday I had a lengthy conversation with Ostakov, on which a telegram follows. I expressed the German wish for remolding German-Russian relations and stated that from the Baltic to the Black Sea there was no problem which could not be solved to our mutual satisfaction. In response to Ostakov's desire for more concrete conversations on topical questions, I declared myself ready for such conversations if the Soviet government would inform me through Ostakov that they also desired to place German-Russian relations on a new and definitive basis." It was known at the Foreign Office that Schulenburg was seeing Molotov later in the day. An hour after Ribbentrop's telegram was dispatched, Weizsäcker got off one of his own, also marked "Secret, most urgent." "In view of the political situation and in the interests of speed, we are anxious, without prejudice to your conversation with Molotov today, to continue in more concrete terms in Berlin the conversations on harmonizing German-Soviet intentions. To this end, Schnurrer will receive Ostakov today, and will tell him that we would be ready for a continuation on more concrete terms." Though Ribbentrop's sudden desire for concrete talks on everything from the Baltic to the Black Sea must have surprised the Russians, at one point, as he informed Schulenburg in his following telegram, which was sent at 3:47 p.m., he "dropped a gentle hint" to Ostakov at our coming to an understanding with Russia on the fate of Poland, the foreign minister emphasized to his ambassador in Moscow that he had told the Russian chargé that "we were in no hurry." This was bluff, and the sharp-minded Soviet chargé called it when he saw Schnurrer at the Foreign Office at 12:45 p.m. He remarked that while Schnurrer seemed to be in a hurry, the German foreign minister the previous day had shown no such urgency. Schnurrer rose to the occasion. "I told Monsieur Ostakov," he noted in a secret memorandum, "that though the foreign minister last night had not shown any urgency to the Soviet government, we nevertheless thought it expedient to make use of the next few days for continuing the conversations in order to establish a basis as quickly as possible." For the Germans, then, it had come down to a matter of the next few days. Ostakov told Schnurrer that he had received a provisional answer from Molotov to the German suggestions. It was largely negative. While Moscow, too, desired an improvement in relations, Molotov said, he reported, that so far nothing concrete was known of Germany's attitude. The Soviet foreign commissar conveyed his ideas directly to Schulenburg in Moscow that evening. The ambassador reported in a long dispatch filed shortly after midnight that in a talk lasting an hour and a quarter, Molotov had abandoned his habitual reserve and appeared unusually open. There seems no doubt of that. For after Schulenburg had reiterated Germany's view that no differences existed between the two countries from the Baltic to the Black Sea, and reaffirmed the German wish to come to an understanding, the unbending Russian minister enumerated some of the hostile acts that the Reich had committed against the Soviet Union: the Anti-Comintern Pact, support of Japan against Russia, and the exclusion of the Soviets from Munich. "How," asked Molotov, "could the new German statements be reconciled with these three points? Proofs of a changed attitude of the German government were, for the present, still lacking." Schulenburg seems to have been somewhat discouraged. "My general impression," he telegraphed Berlin, "is that the Soviet government are at present determined to conclude an agreement with Britain and France, if they fulfill all Soviet wishes. I believe that my statements made an impression on Molotov. It will nevertheless require considerable effort on our part to cause a reversal in the Soviet government's course." Knowledgeable though the veteran German diplomat was about Russian affairs, he obviously overestimated the progress in Moscow of the British and French negotiators. Nor did he yet realize the lengths to which Berlin was now prepared to go to make the considerable effort which he thought was necessary to reverse the course of Soviet diplomacy. In the Wilhelmstrasse, confidence grew that this could be accomplished. With Russia neutralized, Britain and France either would not fight for Poland, or if they did, would easily be held on the western fortifications until the Poles were quickly liquidated and the German army could turn its full strength on the west. The astute French chargé d'affaires in Berlin, Jacques Tarbé de Saint-Ardouin, noticed the change of atmosphere in the German capital. On the very day, August 3rd, when there was so much Soviet-German diplomatic activity in Berlin and Moscow, he reported to Paris, "In the course of the last week, a very definite change in the political atmosphere has been observed in Berlin. The period of embarrassment, hesitation, inclination to temporization, or even to appeasement has been succeeded among the Nazi leaders by a new phase." The hesitation of Germany's allies. It was different with Germany's allies, Italy and Hungary. As the summer progressed, the governments in Budapest and Rome became increasingly fearful that their countries would be drawn into Hitler's war on Germany's side. On July 24th, Count Teleki, Premier of Hungary, addressed identical letters to Hitler and Mussolini, informing them that, in the event of a general conflict, Hungary will make her policy conform to the policy of the Axis. Having gone so far, he then pulled back. On the same day, he wrote the two dictators a second letter, stating that, "In order to prevent any possible misinterpretation of my letter of July 24th, I repeat that Hungary could not, on moral grounds, be in a position to take armed action against Poland." The second letter from Budapest threw Hitler into one of his accustomed rages. When he received Count Shaki, the Hungarian foreign minister, at Obersalzberg on August 8th in the presence of Ribbentrop, he opened the conversation by stating that he had been shocked at the Hungarian prime minister's letter. He emphasized, according to the confidential memorandum drawn up for the Foreign Office, that he had never expected help from Hungary, or from any other state, in the event of a German-Polish conflict. Count Teleki's letter, he added, was impossible, and he reminded his Hungarian guest that it was due to Germany's generosity that Hungary had been able to regain so much territory at the expense of Czechoslovakia. Were Germany to be defeated in war, he said, Hungary would be automatically smashed too. The German memorandum of this conversation, which is among the captured Foreign Office documents, reveals Hitler's state of mind as the fateful month of August got underway. Poland, he said, presented no military problem at all for Germany. Nevertheless, he was reckoning from the start with a war on two fronts. No power in the world, he boasted, could penetrate Germany's western fortifications. Nobody in all my life has been able to frighten me, and that goes for Britain. Nor will I succumb to the oft-predicted nervous breakdown. As for Russia, the Soviet government would not fight against us. The Soviets would not repeat the Tsar's mistake and bleed to death for Britain. They would, however, try to enrich themselves, possibly at the expense of the Baltic states or Poland, without engaging in military action themselves. So effective was Hitler's harangue that at the end of a second talk held the same day, Count Shaki requested him to regard the two letters written by Teleki as not having been written. He said he would also make the same request of Mussolini. For some weeks, the Duce had been worrying and fretting about the danger of the Führer dragging Italy into war. Attolico, his ambassador in Berlin, had been sending increasingly alarming reports about Hitler's determination to attack Poland. Typical was a vivid report Attolico sent of a talk he had with Ribbentrop on July 6th. If Poland dared to attack Danzig, the Nazi foreign minister told him, Germany would settle the Danzig question in 48 hours, at Warsaw. If France were to intervene over Danzig and so precipitate a general war, let her. Germany would like nothing better. France would be annihilated. Britain, if she stirred, would be bringing destruction on the British Empire. Russia? There was going to be a Russian-German treaty, and Russia was not going to march. America? One speech of the Führer's had been enough to rout Roosevelt, and Americans would not stir anyway. Fear of Japan would keep America quiet. I listened, Atolico reported, in wondering silence while Ribbentrop drew this picture of the war ad usum Germaniae, which his imagination has now established indelibly in his head. He can see nothing but his version, which is a really amazing one, of an assured German victory in every field and against all comers. At the end I observed that, according to my understanding, there was complete agreement between the Duce and the Führer that Italy and Germany were preparing for a war that was not to be immediate. But the astute Atolico did not believe that at all. All through July his dispatches warned of imminent German action in Poland. Since early June Mussolini had been pressing for another meeting with Hitler, and in July it was fixed for August 4th at the Brenner. On July 24th he presented to Hitler through Atolico certain basic principles for their discussion. If the Führer considered war inevitable, then Italy would stand by her side. But the Duce reminded him that a war with Poland could not be localized. It would become a European conflict. Mussolini did not think that this was the time for the Axis to start such a war. He proposed instead a constructive, peaceful policy over several years, with Germany settling her differences with Poland and Italy hers with France by diplomatic negotiation. He went further. He suggested another international conference of the big powers. The Führer's reaction, as Ciano noted in his diary on July 26th, was unfavorable, and Mussolini decided it might be best to postpone his meeting with Hitler. He proposed instead on August 7th that the foreign ministers of the two countries meet immediately. Ciano's diary notes during these days indicate the growing uneasiness in Rome. On August 6th, he wrote, "We must find some way out. By following the Germans, we shall go to war and enter it under the least favorable conditions for the Axis, and especially for Italy. Our gold reserves are reduced to almost nothing, as well as our stocks of metals. We must avoid war. I proposed to the Duce the idea of my meeting with Ribbentrop, during which I would attempt to continue discussion of Mussolini's project for a world conference." August 9th. "Ribbentrop has approved the idea of our meeting. I decided to leave tomorrow night in order to meet him at Salzburg. The Duce is anxious that I prove to the Germans, by documentary evidence, that the outbreak of war at this time would be folly." August 10th. "The Duce is more than ever convinced of the necessity of delaying the conflict. He himself has worked out the outline of a report concerning the meeting at Salzburg, which ends with an allusion to international negotiations to settle the problems that so dangerously disturb European life. Before letting me go, he recommends that I shall frankly inform the Germans that we must avoid a conflict with Poland, since it will be impossible to localize it, and a general war would be disastrous for everybody." Armed with such commendable, but in the circumstances, naive thoughts and recommendations, the youthful fascist foreign minister set out for Germany, where during the next 3 days, August 11th, 12th, and 13th, he received from Ribbentrop and especially from Hitler the shock of his life. Ciano at Salzburg and Obersalzburg, August 11th, 12th, 13th. For some 10 hours on August 11th, Ciano conferred with Ribbentrop at the latter's estate at Fuschl, outside Salzburg, which the Nazi foreign minister had taken from an Austrian monarchist who, conveniently, had been put away in a concentration camp. The hot-blooded Italian found the atmosphere, as he later reported, cold and gloomy. During dinner at the White Horse Inn at St. Wolfgang, not a word was exchanged between the two. It was scarcely necessary. Ribbentrop had informed his visitor earlier in the day that the decision to attack Poland was implacable. "Well, Ribbentrop," Ciano says he asked, "what do you want, the corridor or Danzig?" "Not that anymore," Ribbentrop replied, gazing at him with his cold, metallic eyes. "We want war." Ciano's arguments that a Polish conflict could not be localized, that if Poland were attacked, the Western democracies would fight, were bluntly rejected. The day before Christmas Eve, 4 years later, 1943, when Ciano lay in cell 27 of the Verona jail, waiting execution at the instigation of the Germans, he still remembered that chilling day of August 11th at Fuschl and Salzburg. "Ribbentrop," he wrote in his very last diary entry on December 23, 1943, "had bet him, during one of those gloomy meals at the Österreichischer Hof in Salzburg, a collection of old German armor against an Italian painting that France and Britain would remain neutral, a bet, he remarks ruefully, which was never paid. Chano moved on to Obersalzberg, where Hitler, during two meetings on August 12th and 13th, reiterated that France and Britain would not fight. In contrast to the Nazi foreign minister, the Führer was cordial, but he was equally implacable in his determination to go to war. This is evident not only from Chano's reports, but from the confidential German minutes of the meeting, which are among the captured documents. The Italian minister found Hitler standing before a large table covered with military staff maps. He began by explaining the strength of Germany's West Wall. It was, he said, impenetrable. Besides, he added scornfully, Britain could put only three divisions into France. France would have considerably more, but since Poland would be defeated in a very short time, Germany could then concentrate 100 divisions in the West for the life-and-death struggle which would then commence. But would it? A few moments later, annoyed by Chano's initial response, the Führer was contradicting himself. The Italian minister, as he had promised himself, spoke up to Hitler. According to the German minutes, he expressed Italy's great surprise at the entirely unexpected gravity of the situation. Germany, he complained, had not kept her ally informed. On the contrary, he said, the Reich foreign minister had stated, at Milan and Berlin in May, that the Danzig question would be settled in due course. When Chano went on to declare that a conflict with Poland would spread into a European war, his host interrupted to say that he differed. I personally, said Hitler, am absolutely convinced that the Western democracies will, in the last resort, recoil from unleashing a general war. To which Chano replied, the German minutes add, that he hoped the Führer would prove right, but he did not believe it. The Italian foreign minister then outlined in great detail Italy's weaknesses, and from his tale of woe, as the Germans recorded it, Hitler must have been finally convinced that Italy would be of little help to him in the coming war. At one point, Ribbentrop, with obvious exasperation, told Chano, "We don't need you," to which Chano replied, "The future will show." From General Halder's unpublished diary, entry of August 14th, Halder says he got it through Weizsäcker. One of Mussolini's reasons, Chano said, for wanting to postpone the war was that he attached great importance to holding, according to plan, the World Exhibition of 1942, a remark that must have astounded the Führer, lost as he was in his military maps and calculations. He must have been equally astounded when Chano naively produced the text of a communique, which he urged to be published, stating that the meeting of the Axis ministers had reaffirmed the peaceful intentions of their governments and their belief that peace could be maintained through normal diplomatic negotiations. Chano explained that the Duce had in mind a peace conference of the chief European nations, but that out of deference to the Führer's misgivings, he would settle for ordinary diplomatic negotiations. Hitler did not, the first day, turn down completely the idea of a conference, but reminded Chano that Russia could no longer be excluded from future meetings of the powers. This was the first mention of the Soviet Union, but it was not the last. Finally, when Chano tried to pin his host down as to the date of the attack on Poland, Hitler replied that because of the autumn rains, which would render useless his armored and motorized divisions in a country with few paved roads, the settlement with Poland would have to be made one way or another by the end of August. At last, Chano had the date, or the last possible date, for a moment later Hitler was storming that if the Poles offered any fresh provocation he was determined to attack Poland within 48 hours. Therefore, he added, a move against Poland must be expected any moment. That outburst ended the first day's talks, except for Hitler's promise to think over the Italian proposals. Having given them 24 hours' thought, he told Chano the next day that it would be better if no communique of any kind were issued about their talks. Though the German minutes explicitly state that Chano agreed with Hitler that no communique should be issued at the conclusion of the conversation, the Germans immediately double-crossed their Italian ally. DNB, the official German news agency, issued a communique 2 hours after Chano's departure, and without any consultation whatever with the Italians, that the talks had covered all the problems of the day, with particular attention to Danzig, and had resulted in 100% agreement. So much so, the communique added, that not a single problem had been left in suspense. And therefore, there would be no further meetings because there was no occasion for them. Atolico was furious. He protested to the Germans, accusing them of bad faith. He tipped off Henderson that war was imminent, and in an angry dispatch to Rome he described the German communique as Machiavellian, pointing out that it was deliberately done to bind Italy to Germany after the latter's attack on Poland, and pleaded that Mussolini should be firm with Hitler in demanding German fulfillment of the consultation provisions of the Pact of Steel, and under these provisions insist on a month's grace to settle the Danzig question through diplomatic channels. Because of the expected bad weather in the fall, it was of decisive importance, firstly, Hitler told Ciano, that within the shortest possible time Poland should make her intentions plain, and secondly, that no further acts of provocation of any sort should be tolerated by Germany. When Ciano inquired as to what the shortest possible time was, Hitler replied, by the end of August at the latest. While it would take only a fortnight, he explained, to defeat Poland, the final liquidation would require a further 2 to 4 weeks. A remarkable forecast of timing, as it turned out. Finally, at the end, Hitler uttered his customary flattery of Mussolini, whom Ciano must have convinced him he could no longer count on. He personally felt fortunate, he declared, to live at a time when, apart from himself, there was another statesman living who could stand out in history as a great and unique figure. It was a source of great personal happiness that he could be a friend of this man. When the hour struck for the common fight, he would always be found at the side of the Duce, come what may. However much the strutting Mussolini might be impressed by such words, his son-in-law was not. I returned to Rome, he wrote in his diary on August 13th, after the second meeting with Hitler, completely disgusted with the Germans, with their leader, with their way of doing things. They have betrayed us and lied to us. Now they are dragging us into an adventure which we have not wanted, and which might compromise the regime and the country as a whole. But Italy at the moment was the least of Hitler's concerns. His thoughts were concentrating on Russia. Toward the end of the meeting with Ciano on August 12th, a telegram from Moscow, as the German minutes put it, was handed to the Führer. The conversation was interrupted for a few moments while Hitler and Ribbentrop perused it. They then informed Ciano of its contents. The Russians, Hitler said, have agreed to a German political negotiator being sent to Moscow.